One of the most common reasons young readers give for not picking up books in the summer, they say they can't find one they like. All right, kids, put down the iPad, step away from the Xbox, it's time to talk summer reading. We've got fun books, serious books, graphic novels, picture books, all recommended by people who know what they're talking about. Children's librarians, and you. What's the one book you wish every kid would read? Call us at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet at 21st Show. And later in the hour, Illinois college students are jumping on their bikes and riding across the country to help those affected by cancer tell their own stories.
The man came out of his house to offer us water and a bathroom and was just really, really generous. And we learned that his mom, mother-in-law, aunt, and niece all passed away from cancer. And he was just extremely brutally honest about how that's affected him and kind of the demons that he's dealing with due to that loss.
It's all part of the Portraits Project. I'm Scott Cameron. That's coming up today on the 21st. And welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. Nyla Boodoo is away. Summer means a lot of things, including making times to read. So for the next in our summer book series today, we're going to talk about books for kids. We've got two librarians who are full of ideas. We'll also talk with an author who writes nonfiction children's books. And you've already been sending us your suggestions this morning all on social media. You can also now give us a call. What one book would you recommend for kids? 800-222-9455 is our number, 800-222-9455. Later in the hour, we'll talk with two college students from Illinois who are cycling across the country. They're documenting their stories of people who've been affected by cancer. But first, summer reads for kids, and we've got a couple of experts here to help us. Diane Foote is curator at Butler's Children's Literature Center at Dominican University, on the phone with us from their campus in River Forest. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for joining us. And Jesse Weyer, children's librarian at the Bloomington Library. He's on the phone with us from an office there. Hey, Jesse.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the 21st. Let's just jump right in. I mean, you guys have put together some great suggestions for folks. But, you know, one thing that, Diane, I think you had mentioned was, you know, we're talking about summer reading here, all over the summer here on the 21st. You've got some ideas with some books that kind of stick to that idea of summertime for kids.
I do. That's right, Scott. Summer is a time when kids can read what they want. They don't have to read what they're supposed to for school. The field is wide open. So kind of a classic thing to do is to share books with kids about typical things that you do over the summer. Not all kids get to go away for the summer, so some of these books have to do with fun things you can do at home. One is called The Secret Tree Fort by Brianne Farley. This is a new one just out. What I like about this one is it's got two kids, and one of the kids is real active and wants to climb in a tree, and the other one wants to sit there and read, which is very funny. So it's about how they come to a meeting of the minds. We've got a few others. One's called The Not So Far Away Adventure, where a girl and her grandfather go to the beach on the streetcar. We've got City Shapes, which is by Diana Murray, illustrated by Brian Collier, about all kinds of things you can look for, shapes that you can find in your everyday city landscape if you don't have the opportunity to go away. There's a couple, one called Puddle and another one called Float, which both have to do with the time-honored favorite pastime of stamping in puddles.
And we've had plenty of rain here, I think, in Illinois this summer so far. And I should mention to everybody, too, and we're going to run through these relatively quickly, but we will list these books, you know, at our website. A lot of them are already up there. But if for people who are looking for these, they can go online to 21stshow.org, and we'll have the full list there. And Jesse, let me pull you in here on this. I know we've got sort of a list here, and I don't mean to throw you a curveball here, but any of these that you're looking at right now that kind of have that idea of like a summer theme to them, something about a summer camp or a summer experience, anything like that?
We actually have a display right now of sports books, since the theme this summer for libraries is Read for the Win, one of the big themes. So we've been doing I can't remember the title of it, but there we have a whole display of mostly baseball, because that's what's really big around here right now. We have
that's in honor of the Cubs, right?
For me, it is. Yes.
Me too.
Sorry, Cardinals fans. That's a good. So finding these kind of themes. I mean, and do you find, Jesse, that by picking out themes like, you know, to win or sports or, you know, camping, things like that, that it gets kids' attention a little more, maybe pulls them in at a time when there's a lot of other things going around over the summer other than sitting down and reading a book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the theme of staying active in the summer, both reading-wise and then physically, I think kids pick up on that very much.
You know, one thing I wanted to check in on, you know, we talked about children's books. What does that mean? Is there a definition of, and I guess, Diane, I'll ask you this, is there a definition of children's books in terms of age range?
Sure. The Association for Library Service to Children is the group that brings us the Newbery and Caldecott Book Award, mm-hmm. along with many other book awards. They have one for nonfiction. They have one for books for beginning readers. They have one for books that by and about the Latino experience. And ALSC defines children as age zero, literally from the very youngest all the way up through age 14.
Okay.
So you can imagine that the books that win these awards, some of them are suitable for the very youngest kids, some of them are suitable for, you know, a little bit as kids as old as the first teenagers, 13 and 14.
Yeah, I mean, that is quite a range, and trying to figure out, you know, what makes sense at different ages and ranges. I mean, at home right now, I've got a massive plastic bin that's just full of books and we kind of pull out of from time to time. You know, why don't we start, I guess, coming back to some of the idea of some of the younger readers then. With those picture books, you both had talked about books for very, very early, young kids. Jesse, why don't we start with you? You had recommended a book, a picture book called Farmyard Beat by Lindsay Craig. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I love this book. The illustrations, which are very important with the younger kids, are a little different, so they're kind of eye-catching. But the most important part about this book, it's very musical. You can sing it. When I read this book in story times, which I actually did earlier this week, I sing it and I snap while I'm singing it. It's got a beat to it. That gets parents involved. It gets the kids involved. Everyone loves it. And kids learn, the younger kids like that, learn words through song first.
Yeah, and it's amazing how quickly they can pick it up when there's that kind of a repetition and pattern to it.
Yeah, that's a great one. The kids love that. Story time favorite.
Nice. So Farmyard Beat by Lindsay Craig. Mm-hmm. What's another one for the very, very early kids, young kids, that's on that list there of picture books that you think stands out?
Yeah, I think Duck Rabbit is one of my favorites by Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Another one, illustrations are very important. It's basically based on one single picture, one image, and it depends on your perception what it looks like. It looks like a duck to some people, and it looks like a rabbit to other people. The bill looks like ears to some people, or vice versa. So, and there are two characters in the book who play off of that. Who one of them thinks it's a duck, one thinks it's a rabbit. So it's a very good read with children. You could have them play one of the parts because the text is very simple. We did a story time where two of us read it and we played a part and we did voices for the parts, and it's kids really, really enjoy that. She's a great author also.
Nice. Okay. And again, kind of very, you know, kids are very visual. So giving them something that they can look at, play along with, get them involved in storytelling instead of just sitting there and making it a one-way kind of experience. Diane, coming back, you've also got a number of things here on your list for the young kids in terms of picture books and things. Where do you want to start there?
Well, there are actually two books out this year, both with the exact same title, and you're both going to laugh when I say it. The title of both books is Are We There Yet? And they're both picture books, and they're both meant to be enjoyed by kids on a long car ride. So I really appreciated, Jesse, what you were saying about the illustrations being important and really being able to involve a kid in the actual reading experience. Reading looks from the outside like it might be passive, but it's really very active when you have the right kinds of books at hand.
Nice. And who writes Are We There Yet?
I do, yes. One of them is by Nina Ladin and illustrated by Adam McCauley. The other one is written and illustrated by Dan Suntat, who was actually is a Caldecott Medal winning illustrator.
Okay, nice.
And a graphic novel creator.
Okay. And not to spoil the ending, I'm sure they get there, but it's a story. There are both stories about kids and cars and that experience.
They both take place in the car, and they both have a lot of hidden detail in the illustrations that take time to pore over and look through, and they would both be good to hand an antsy kid in the back seat.
Nice. Okay, now coming up a little bit in age, and stepping back a little bit here, I think, too, because we're talking about some specific books, and we have a big list here. We'll get to all of these, and like I said, they're also up on our website. But especially as kids get a little bit older, you know, it can be tough sometimes. You've got the iPad, you've got Xbox, you've got whatever's going around, you've got friends up and down the street, you've got the pool down the street. It can be a challenge sometimes, and I know this from experience, to get kids to sit down and read. And then there's that balance between, you know, the kid might want to sit down and pick up, a comic book or a graphic novel or, you know, a diary of a Minecraft zombie. And, well, are they getting anything out of that? As a parent, should I have them, no, you should be reading this book because you're going to learn something. How do you balance that? Do you have any advice for parents in that way?
I do have advice for parents in that way, particularly over the summer. Let the kids read what they want. it all, and I'm going to put this in air quotes, it all counts. Hmm. Magazines count, comic books count, newspapers count, even reading on a screen counts, but you don't want to do that all the time. There's nothing wrong with a screen as long as it's leavened with actual print materials. But it all counts. There's really no substitute for knowing a kid's interest when making recommendations for books. We all know, or I shouldn't say we all know, research shows that real pleasure in reading results later in increased skill in reading and writing. But a kid has to really like it first. Nobody wants, especially reading over the summer, to feel like homework or work or something that isn't pleasurable. Summer is a time, and libraries are places where kids can explore a wide, wide variety of interests that they might not have the opportunity to do in their classroom.
So in terms of, you know, if you needed to think about it like a goal for the summer, the goal is not necessarily to advance a child's reading level or to, you know, move them on to some sort of advanced books. The goal is just to get them reading, and it sounds like you're saying really to get them to like it, if not even love it.
To get them to like it will result in gains.
And then eventually see that over time. And Jesse, I know there's a lot of things that are going on, you know, in the Bloomington Library that I saw to kind of pull kids in. You mentioned one kind of the winning theme with some of the sports books and stuff. I mean, what other ways do you find, Jesse, to deal with and sort of pull in reluctant readers?
Sure. We actually, one of the most popular programs for reluctant readers we have Wednesday nights, we have a program called Tales for Tales. And what we do is bring in certified therapy dogs.
Hmm.
And the kids get to read aloud to the dogs. And it's brilliant, really. the kids love it, obviously. I mean, most kids love dogs.
Yeah.
And some kids can't have pets where they live. So we kind of killed two birds with a stone here. I mean, we get the kids reading who might not be at the library reading otherwise.
And they might even realize they're reading. They're there to see the dog and have fun. And, oh, by the way, we're going to have a book, and this
for
is great.
It's almost a different, you know, experience. They're not thinking of it as reading, and they're thinking of it as having a good time, like Diane mentioned. I love that. We want them to enjoy it.
Nice. Okay, cool.
And I think reading to an animal, reading to a dog, takes off so much of the pressure when a kid has to read out loud in a classroom or even read with his family. There's always somebody looking and checking.
Oh, that's it. There's no judgment from a dog.
There's no judgment. It's just great.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I wanted to get a couple of recommendations coming here on Facebook. Zani says, one book for kids to read is The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate.
Ivan.
She says it's fantastic. Do you guys? It sounds like you guys know that one. What can you tell me a little bit about The One and Only Ivan?
The One and Only Ivan is a Newbery Award winner, and it is a story based on a true story of a gorilla that was kept in kind of a roadside down at the Heal Zoo. And the plot by a little girl and a dog, and you know they talk to kind of free him.
Hmm. Okay, so a neat story there, and again involving animals and things that kids are gonna. Be drawn into. She says, same person here, Zani on Facebook, the other book she has for kids over 11 is called Echo by Pam Munoz-Ryan. She says it's a thoughtful and caring book that touches on issues like racism, the Holocaust, and human redemption. Do you know Echo?
I do, and it is also an award winner, and I think highly, highly recommended. Pam Munoz-Ryan is a very well-known writer. She's got several books that appeal to that age level and deal with these weighty issues, but in a way that's accessible for kids. You know, sometimes I think parents get worried. I know I, as a parent, get worried sometimes that my child is going to come across something that's troubling in a book, but I'd much rather have him come to it in a book before he has to face it in real life. This one also has kind of a prophecy and a puzzle, a mystery aspect to it, so it can appeal to a wide range of kids.
Hmm. And having that kind of environment to bring up these issues and then the parent also knowing it and knowing what this book is gives a chance to talk about them in that kind of safe environment at home.
Right.
All right.
For sure.
You know, I wanted to ask, and we've just got a couple of minutes here before we need to take a short break here, but reading some of those issues, you know, racism, the Holocaust, human redemption, they are big issues. They're also things that I think, at least I feel like we might be seeing more in kids' books, that we're seeing a greater diversity of topics, of authors, of people showing up within the books, even in the picture books. Is that in my head, or is that something that's happening right now?
Well, I think it's happening, and it's starting to happen. It needs to happen a lot more. But I feel like, having been involved in children's books for over 20 years now, I feel like there's much more of an awareness and an interest in books by and about all types of people than we've ever seen before, and it's
mm-hmm.
really gratifying. There was an article published, 40 years ago called The All-White World of Children's Books, and it's so valuable to share books with kids about and by people of other ethnicities, whether the reader, him or herself, is a person of color or a white kid or white suburban kid or whoever they are. It's helpful to read books that about people who look like you and whose cultural experience mirrors yours, and it's just as valuable to read about kids and experiences that don't mirror yours.
Well, and isn't that what stories are supposed to be about, is about experiencing other places, other people, other experience that you will never be able to do maybe in your own shoes?
Absolutely. Stories are about both. It's about affirming your own experience and introducing you to new ones. So there's a movement called We Need Diverse Books Now that has been going for some time. It's got a website and a lot of initiatives going on, and I encourage folks to check that out. There's book recommendations and activities and a hashtag and everything else to keep this kind of in the forefront.
Okay. All right, and just to finish up here, a couple of quick ones. You know, Jess, I'm going to pick up your list here. In terms of the picture books here, Paper Bag Princess by Robert Munsch, and Breathe. What is this one? Can you help me out? Breathe B, Scott Magoon?
Breathe by Scott Magoon. It's a little newer. I think it was about 2 years ago. And since I do the preschool story times here, 3 to 5 year olds. And this one I like because most of the stuff I do, I mean, kids want silly, they want fun, they want interactive. And every once in a while, you got to slow it down. And I like Breathe a lot. It's a very, very calming book. Minimal text, and the story in general is just very calming. And I'm doing a sort of a yoga-esque story time this summer, and this is one of the books I've included. So if you need something to calm down after the silly books, this is an excellent, excellent
book. Yeah, and for some of those kids, too, that you know have trouble kind of sitting still a little bit, that could be a nice thing for them, too. Well, we're talking children's books, summer reading today. Up next, an author of books for kids joins us to talk about her secrets for writing for young readers. We'll also be taking your calls and tweets. What's the one book you think every kid should read? 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. I'm Scott Cameron, and this is The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
It's summer reading day here on the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. And since I got to pick the theme today as I'm guest hosting, we're talking books for kids. A couple of things we've heard here on social media, a recommendation from Faith on Facebook. It looks like her child loves Mo Willems' book, Don't Let Pigeon Drive the Bus, and the Pigeon series, and also Should I Share My Ice Cream, one of the Elephant and Piggy books, another one that I know well here. Says she also read a lot of Dr. Seuss, and she her child currently loves Curious George. Some other ones, a comment from Ian in Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you for your comment here today. It says a very summery, very good book called Goodnight, Layla Tove, Layla, L-A-I-L-A-T-O-V, by Laurel Schneider. Also, The Lion and the Bird by Mary Ann, Dubuc, D-U-B-U-C. And then Susanna in Seattle, Washington, recommending John Birmingham's, Trubloff, T-R-U-B-L-O-F-F, says it's a story about a mouse who lives with dreams of becoming the greatest player in the whole country. Also by Birmingham, Borka, a story of a goose with no feathers. So some ideas there, some recommendations we're getting in on Facebook and on Twitter. With us on the phone, Jesse Weyer, children's librarian at the Bloomington Library, and also Diane Foote, curator at Butler Children's Literature Center at Dominican University. We talked a lot about sort of the younger age books. Let's move up a little bit here before we get to some other bigger things. But I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, how do parents pick some books? What are some resources people can look to? You know, there's a lot out there right now. But why don't we move up here to some of the, kind of middle school, I guess, grade school ages. Jesse, you listed a couple here under chapter books. There's one here that I know well, actually, from my own kids, the Magic Treehouse series, Mary Pope Osborne. Can you brief us a little bit about that series?
The Magic Treehouse is Mary Pope Osborne is prolific. There are so many Magic Treehouse books, and it is the most popular series in our library by far for that age group. And there's a lot of history involved. They basically sneak a lot of education into these books, but they're also still adventurous. So I would highly, highly recommend that. And that's, I mean, there are enough Magic Treehouse books to keep a child busy over the entire summer.
I will attest to that. You also listed Amelia Bedelia. There's a name that a lot of people will know by Herman Parrish. Still going strong, huh?
Still going strong. Amelia Bedelia. I like Amelia Bedelia. There are a lot of ways in which she takes everything literally. So we use, you know, if we turn a phrase, but she takes it literally, and that's it's fun when they get the even starting in the picture books. I think there are some Amelia Bedelia picture books, and so the illustrations of her doing something like falling head over heels, she actually falls head over heels. This kind of thing, like it's a very silly thing that kids pick up on and enjoy.
Nice. And then Diane, just kind of going quickly through a list here of you've got what under middle grade novels. What stands out to you there?
Yeah, the things that stand out to me there, my most favorite project that I did when I was in graduate school to become a librarian, and yes, folks, you do need to go to grad school to become a librarian, was a project that analyzed books that had high literary quality as well as child appeal. So I think both of those things really need to be present. And the three that came up during the time that I was in graduate school were Bud Not Buddy by Christopher Paul Curtis, which won both the Newbery and the Coretta Scott King Book Awards when it came out. That's a real achievement, and it's a great read. It's a coming age of story about a young orphan in search of his family. It's historical fiction, takes place in the 1930s jazz age, and there's a lot in there to like about it. The other two that came up at that time that were published around that time are Because of Winn-Dixie by Kate DiCamillo and Holes by Louis Sackard, both of which have been made into
major movies. Yeah. All right, nice. So Bud Not Buddy by Christopher Paul Curtis, Because of Winn-Dixie and Holes, both popular ones. I mentioned, you know, both of you have referred to books and said, you know, oh, this is a this award winner, this is a that award winner. I mean, awards, again, just speaking from somebody who stared at endless shelves of books in stores or, you know, gone to libraries and or to Amazon and whatnot. How are awards good ways for parents and others to try to find books that are good for kids? What do you recommend there?
I think so. I think the Diane mentioned the Caldecott and the Newbery, and those are big ones, and the Coretta Scott King, all excellent awards. And I think we are here locally in Illinois. The Illinois School Library Media Association Awards are another good way to keep up on it. The Monarch is the K-3 award. The Blue Stem is the 3rd to 5th grade award, and then the Rebecca Caudle is the 4th through 8th grade. And I think it's a really good. We actually have displays of all of those at the library, and they check out heavily. And you know, they're like she was saying, it's a good mix of something with literary merit, but also something that kids enjoy, and they check out a lot.
Jesse, tell the readers who actually votes on those. Is it adults?
No. Yeah. Yes. It is the readers. It is the readers.
Oh, nice.
Readers,
so kids get a say too, huh?
On those.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. And you said it was an Illinois group, so those are readers in Illinois voting on the best books that they're reading right now.
Yep.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, as we were putting together today's segment, I realized that we're talking about children's books really only from the perspective of the readers, the parents, the kids, the librarians. I don't know a thing about what authors go through trying to write for young audiences. Suzanne Slade not only writes books for kids, but she writes nonfiction books for kids. An Illinois author, some of her books, Friends for Freedom, The Inventor's Secret, some of the latest there. She's on the line with us from her home in the Libertyville area. Suzanne, it's nice to talk with you.
Well, it's great to be on your show this morning because you're talking about my most favorite thing in the world.
Well, you're a writer. You're a parent yourself. You're sort of immersed in this world. I mean, can you take us inside that world a little bit? How do you write stories, particularly nonfiction stories, that are going to appeal to younger readers?
Well, usually my starting point is if I hear about something, I never go looking for a book idea. Just in the course of my day, my week, I will hear something random or run across something that I'm very interested in or curious about, and then I'll start doing a little research. And if I see a story there, then that's where the story starts. Usually after that point, I've got about 6 weeks to get a good rough draft. Then I've got my critique friends give it a look over, and literally 50 more edits, and then I might run it past an editor and see what they think.
So your critique friends, are they 12 years old?
they are other children's writers. Interestingly, writers, I mean, you might have a child read it, but generally you look to other writers for advice, for critiquing on a piece.
Nice. And, you know, I understand that you got one story idea from your son. Is that right?
Well, I've gotten one from my daughter. I have a book for the very young called Animals Are Sleeping.
Okay.
And one time, I'm from Indiana, we were driving back home for Thanksgiving. We drove past an Amish farm, and she points out the window, and she said, oh, they sleep standing up. And she was pointing to horses, which led me to think about the different ways animals sleep, and that became Animals Are Sleeping.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, you know, you've got a background in science and in engineering. You know, how does that show up in your books?
Well, I think it shows up because some of my books feature science because I'm really interested and curious in science, about science. And as I go and do author school visits, I find children are very interested in science, too. Inventions, creating. That was kind of what led to my book. You'd mentioned Inventor's Secret. I love seeing how inventors bought up their original inventions, and Thomas Edison is one of my inventor heroes.
Mm-hmm.
So that book came about when I learned how he inspired Henry Ford when he was working on creating a gas car.
Huh. And where did you find it? I mean, I assume you researched like any other biographer, and you know, you just have to make it so that the language and the storyline is suitable for younger readers, huh?
Especially with when you're talking about science content, is how do I make it understandable, accurate, and interesting? So those are kind of the key points I'm trying to hit and create a storyline that's engaging, you know, that yeah. really interests the child.
Well, just thinking too about the topic here, and you know, you've talked about, you know, your own family and whatnot. Were there strategies that you used with your own kids when it came to reading, and particularly over the summer?
Well, good question, because I have what might be called a ready reader. My son was always very interested in reading, had a book in his hand every night. My daughter was what might be called a reluctant reader.
Hmm.
So my strategy, my daughter's interested in animals, so I started getting her nonfiction books about animals.
Nice. So again, coming back to a little bit what we talked about earlier, I think Dan was talking about, you know, matching the interests of the child up to the books that you try to get them to read.
Exactly. You know, very important. And when she was young, her friends were reading The Babysitter's Club, which mm-hmm. are great books, but they weren't for her. So I needed to think about and find what she was interested in.
Yeah, and adapt based on what she was looking for. All right, well, I appreciate that. What are we going to see next from you at this point?
In September, you will see The Music in George's Head. It's about how George Gershwin wrote Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, nice. All right, that's a cool topic. So, thank you for taking us kind of inside the perspective there of somebody who's, I guess you're on both sides of this. You are looking for the books and have been looking for books that are going to get your own kids interested, but you're also trying to turn those into stories for other readers. So, thank you very much. Suzanne Slade, children's author based right here in Illinois, joined us on the phone from her home in Libertyville. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And, of course, we still have with us Jesse Weyer, a children's librarian at the Bloomington Library, Diane Foote, curator at Butler's Children's Literature Center at Dominican University. You know, as you guys see a lot of these books coming in, you know, from writers like Suzanne and others, what's your process about deciding? You've only got a certain amount of space on those shelves. I mean, Jesse, how do you decide what goes up, you know, what books you're going to buy and make available to readers?
Well, luckily here we have selectors for different sections. So we specialize in certain sections. I actually do ebooks, so the space issue doesn't come up as much for me, but the my coworkers definitely deal with that. I mean, the nonfiction section in particular, because it's a little bit smaller than the fiction section, you really have to make every inch count. So we have selectors specifically who deal with that, and as you do it, you get better and better and better. You know exactly the series that people are drawn to, authors that people are drawn to, characters, that kind of thing, and you want to really hone in on that. And you can check circulation stats and stuff like that, but being all of our selectors also man our reference desk, which I think really, really helps see what kids are looking for, because circulation stats don't tell the whole story. Some kids read a lot of books in the library and don't actually check them out. They just read them while they're there. Mm-hmm. So being on that desk and seeing what people are reading really, really helps.
Well, and looking down your list here, Jesse, some of the things you sent over, while we're on the topic of nonfiction, you do have two recommendations of kid nonfiction books. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. The Brown Girl Dreaming is a bio by Jacqueline Woodson, and I absolutely love this book. I read it in grad school, and she writes in poetry, so the entire biography is written in poetry form. It's a really interesting biography, but I think the form itself, like getting kids to read poetry, is not a very easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that it's a biography, because we do have a lot of kids asking for those, you know, some for just personal interest and then some for school projects. And I always like to steer them towards that because it does combine those two. Very rare that you see something like a biography written in poetry form.
Yeah.
And then the series, Who Was or Who Is, is probably the most popular nonfiction series that we have here at this library. And it's, if it's still a living person, it's Who Is, like Who Is Michelle Obama, or the who was Thomas Edison, for example. And part of it is that I like the art on the front. It's sort of caricatures of them.
The giant head.
Big heads. Yes, the big heads, and the kids love that. It draws them to that. And then they're well written also, and fairly short to the point.
Okay, nice. And it's sort of wrapping up here. We just got a couple of minutes left, but both of you had a number of graphic novels on your list. You know, you talked about, especially with some of the non-traditional reluctant readers, that can be a great way to draw some kids in. What jumps out at you there? And Diane, why don't we turn to you first?
Sure, absolutely. I like that Jesse mentioned series, and I think kids, especially reluctant readers, like things that are familiar. So there are a couple of really, really popular graphic novel series that have very sophisticated story arcs. So when parents look at these things, they shouldn't think, oh, it's just comics. They're really very sophisticated, well-developed stories. One of them is the Bone series by Jeff Smith, super popular. Another one is Cheese Sweet Home, which is about a little boy who finds a kitten. And this is, 12 books long about the story arc about this kitten and the family and where did the kitten come from. Another one is the Amulet series by Kazuo Kibuishi. The Amulet series and Bone both have fantasy elements in it, both have kind of this overarching good versus evil archetypal struggle going on, but they're comics, and they're really fun.
Nice. And Jesse, how about you? You've got a couple listed here under graphic novels.
Sure. I did a couple of standalones. One of them is El Defo by C.C. Bell, just a fantastic graphic novel. The main character is deaf and struggles with that, and you get to see that from not only her perspective, but her classmates' perspective, her peers. And it's really interesting to see how they all interact with her and how she views herself and how they view her, and that sort of dichotomy of where she is and where she sees herself and where they see her. It's a beautiful book. And then Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson. An interesting one. I have a friend who does roller derby, and she turned me onto this book before a librarian did, which is saying a lot in this community. It's about a girl who gets into roller derby, sort of a little bit alternative from, the mainstream. And it's a time when she is, her and her best friend are sort of parting ways, and she's finding this new community to accept her. And I think it's something that kids all can relate to at that age level, of trying to find acceptance somewhere and trying to develop your personality and find out what you actually enjoy.
So Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson. Well, we are out of time there.
So
we didn't get a chance to touch on all this stuff, so we're going to post all of these up on the website. Dan, I could hear you getting in there. I'm sorry, we are out of time here. But Jesse Weyer, children's librarian at the Bloomington Library, Diane Foote, curator at Butler's Children's Literature Center at Dominican University. It sounds like we can probably talk again, but thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And coming up, why 18 college students are cycling from New York to California to document stories of cancer.
At first, I want to know more about American culture and American landscapes. So that's the reason why I joined this group at first. But then after I joined this group, I found out my grandpa was diagnosed as stomach cancer. So I want to write this as an encouragement for him and for my mother, for my family.
We'll talk with two of the Illinois students behind the Portraits Project. Stay with us. I'm Scott Cameron, and this is The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron.
When I was 8 years old in 1999, my mother passed away of cervical cancer. And I still remember the day that I found out she had died. I was actually in second grade, and my dad and my stepmom showed up at the classroom door, and they said that they were there to pick me up. We walked outside, and I remember looking up at my stepmom and asking why my brother was crying. And she said, "Your mom passed away this morning." This cancer not only stole my mom's life, but it stole my childhood because I was constantly taking care of my mom.
There's power in telling our own stories. It's often a way to connect with people who've had similar experiences. Sometimes it even helps us come to terms with difficult moments. You can hear all of that in the voices of the people whose lives have been changed by cancer and have shared their stories through what's called the Portraits Project. A group of college students from Illinois are in the middle of a 4,000-mile bike ride across the country. They're documenting stories, just like the one we just heard there, talking with people affected by cancer who they meet along the way. The group is known as the Illini 4,000. They passed through Champaign yesterday. Dakota Carson and Lindsay Coleman are two members of that team, and they stopped by the studio to talk with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
So we heard a portion there of that conversation. A woman named Shay, who you both spoke with recently, lost her mother to cancer in 1999. Even now, I get the sense from listening to her voice that this is difficult for her to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, or do you get a sense of why people are so willing to tell these very personal stories to people who ride up and are really strangers?
I think most of them understand how powerful the story can be and how powerful it can be for others to hear it. So they, I think, are helping us kind of set perspective for our lives, and also knowing that their story is going to be shared on the internet. I hope they know that they're probably going to change the lives of other people who are listening to their stories and possibly going through the same things.
Mm-hmm. And have people said that to you after you talk with them? Have they sort of talked a little bit about why they did choose to talk or what they hope happens next from their stories?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that for them, it's a part of the healing process, too, and the grieving process, you know, sharing the insides of what you've gone through in life, trying to connect to others and know that maybe someone else can connect to you and learn from it. It helps you. It helps you in that grieving process. So I think it's really powerful for not only to be the listener, but also to be the voice in those who are sharing it.
Yeah. Can you take us a little bit inside the process? So you've, how many people are right now writing as part of this project?
Writing in the team?
Yeah.
There's 18 of us. We have eight, or there was 19, but now there's 18.
Yeah. So 18, yeah. You can see, you know, you're dressed up with the Illini 4000, yeah. You know, the gear and everything. So if you're out on the highway, you can see the team, you know, traveling coast to coast. Mm-hmm. You're going 4,000 miles. And then you arrive in a town or a community or a city or wherever you're going to be stopping. And how do you find people to talk to?
So a lot of the times when we'll stop for like a rest stop in the middle of the day or stop for lunch, we are definitely a sight to be seen in our neon and spandex. And so people will ask us and we'll tell them and we'll give our little elevator pitch about who we are and what we do. And many, many times they'll be like, "Oh, that's so cool. Like, I had cancer or my ex-relative had cancer." And so then we do, like, it is kind of an awkward transition to be like, "Oh, we do the Portrait Project. Would you like to share your story?"
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it usually happens very casually. We're all kind of getting used to asking that question, and it was definitely a learning curve at the beginning. But yeah, it's usually just like where we stop or at our rest stay over for the end of the day. Sometimes they'll like have prearranged people who they know from their community that want to talk to us.
And you said, we should point out too that you said that there were 19, now there's 18. Somebody got hurt and is sitting out this. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah, but not seriously injured. No one has yet been. We're very lucky. We're a very safe team, and no one has been so injured. Yeah, that.
Just for people who are wondering what, you know,
yeah,
what happened.
Yeah, just letting you know.
There are, you know, it's interesting because there are, in the Illini 4000, they raise money. They do a lot of different things and projects during the course of the year. But, you know, there are many ways to raise money and raise awareness for cancer. So why bike 4,000 miles across the country like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think that biking... We, from 5:45 in the morning till about 10 at night, we are awake and working, and we bike for 8 hours a day. And it's a lot of, it's a physical journey and an emotional one as well. Mm-hmm. You're putting yourself to your limits. You are testing your abilities. And I think that for me personally, I've really felt like that experience kind of replicates or parallels to that someone who may be suffering through cancer. And I'm not saying they are any comparison at all.
Mm-hmm. But you're putting yourself out there too. You're putting your mind, your body, your everything out on the road as mm-hmm. well.
And it's what we do is such a rigorous routine, mm-hmm. such a daily routine. We do it for 72 days straight, bike 72 days straight. And to hear the stories through the Portraits Project and hear the people who are saying, we get chemo 5 days a week. That is their routine. And to know that they too are going through a routine that just drains them physically, emotionally, mentally, I personally really connect to that by what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be a little why, for me, why the biking is such a more impactful way.
Yeah. And I'll ask this to both of you, but I guess I'll turn to Lindsay first. What brought you to this project? She just described it is a grueling process. It's doing a lot of good, and I can see the way it's connecting people and bringing stories forward and things. Mm-hmm. But what brought you to this?
So I had a friend who did the same thing 4 years ago, and I knew her through my church, and I really looked up to her, and she was kind of a mentor for me as a freshman. She was a senior, and I thought it was amazing what she did, and I knew that I wanted to do the same thing. So I worked in college the first 3 summers, and then I knew I wanted to do this. And over that period of time, I actually had people come into my life that had, their mothers were going through cancer, or they had relatives who had died from cancer. And so that just made it even more real for me and got me even more excited about joining. So, yeah, and also, I knew I wanted to challenge myself and to join the team and be on a team again that was all working towards the same thing. And, yeah.
And Dakota, same question.
Why did I join Illini 4000?
Yeah.
For me, going into my senior year of college, I knew that I wanted to continue the journey for what I want to do for the future, which is journalism. And finding Illini 4000 and finding the Portraits Project primarily is really what got me hooked, because I find it so amazing that I can be someone in the face of the people and getting to help them share their stories. And I've been affected. My family's been affected by cancer. My sister had cervical cancer, and my grandpa died from lung cancer. And so cancer has touched me personally, but what I find so amazing is that, you know, we left New York City 19 days ago, and we're here in Champaign, and along for 19 days, we have heard people share their stories, and cancer affects everyone. Cancer is universal, no matter what. And to me, I want to make a bigger impact to ending that. I don't think cancer should be something that people should know so well. It shouldn't be something common.
And it really is universal. I mean, both of you sitting there have personal experience, personal stories of your own to share with it. It makes me wonder, too, then, as you're hearing story after story after story of, you know, survivors, people touched by cancer, and people who didn't have such a happy ending to it in some cases, what's that like for you, then, to hear and to experience that on the listening side?
It's hard. It's so hard. I think for me personally, the hardest day was at Relay for Life in Zanesville, which Shay's interviews from. We sat through 6 portraits that day, mm-hmm. and these are 20 to 30 minute long portraits of these people just opening up and sharing what they went through or what they are going through. And it is, it's so hard because I can understand to a certain extent as a human, but then there's a part of me that has no idea. And that's, it's scary to know that that's what can, what something can do to you. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Lindsay.
Yeah. Towards the beginning of this, we had only, or I had really only interacted with survivors or people who had relatives. And so while it still affected them, it wasn't immediately in their life. And then on day like 4 or 5, I met this lady in the parking lot of a gas station and I told her what we were doing. And she told me, I just got my diagnosis, so keep me in your prayers. And that moment made it like really, really real for me because I kind of was like, there are people right now who are just mm-hmm. starting this horrible process and they haven't beat it yet and they might not. And so that was definitely a moment for me. And it was really hard. It is really hard. It's very emotional. And like I was told that after having just biked 50 miles. And so it's like there's a lot going on and you just, I think it definitely has changed all of us so far and like gives like builds character and makes you strong and mm-hmm. definitely yeah.
In that moment, I mean, you were there for that mm-hmm. person in that parking lot to be able to share that story at a moment probably they really needed to tell, you know, to tell that story. Mm-hmm. It's speaking of stories, you know, there's another, you recently talked, both of you, I think, with another woman named Kathy, mm-hmm. also mm-hmm. at the Relay for Life event in Ohio. In this case, her mother was diagnosed first with breast cancer, later with multiple myeloma.
In 2011, she had decided that quality of life was more important, and I guess things had, you know, come to a point where she did turn to palliative care, and that actually was a great year for her. We took a family trip to New Jersey, and my dad had turned 85 in the fall, and we had a great outdoor party, and she was just feeling well, and but she did have a fall in December, and they were almost done with the hip surgery, but she passed away during the surgery. And when she had decided in February to stop the chemo treatments, and she was ready, she was at peace with, you know, the great life she'd had, and she had a good faith in the Lord, and none of us in the family had any regrets.
Again, you can hear there's somebody, you're helping somebody to remember and to share a story and something that they're going to have that then goes up on the website, on the Portraits Project, you know, for a long time for them. Are there other stories in particular? We were only able to share two here, you know, in the time that we have. But are there others that stand out to you, other things that you don't stop thinking about after you say goodbye?
Yeah, definitely. I have two on the top of my head. But most recently, actually, two days ago, I stopped for coffee in a small town because it was raining, so me and my team stopped and we were trying to take a picture and someone came up to us and to take the photo for us, and we of course gave the spiel like Lindsay said, and the gentleman said, oh well, I was just diagnosed a month ago with pancreatic cancer and I found out that I have 6 months to live. And from that moment we did a portrait, and after the portrait, emotions just overcame me. And you know, you question, you say to yourself, like, what does that mean? Like, what does that feel like to know that this gentleman has 6 months to live? And so for me, like, sometimes when I'm writing, I think of those people that I'm writing for, and he is one of them. Because on July 6th, he will be having his first surgery. And he is in my thoughts. He's in my prayers. He is someone that we will be dedicating our ride. Every day we dedicate our ride to somebody, whether it's a teammate's relative, a friend, or someone we meet on the ride, that we ride for that day. And he will be one of those people.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, that's, I think people here will remember that for a long time, just hearing the story too. You're now, you have 18 students, you're about a quarter of the way through this trip. It's a 72-day trip across the country, starting in New York, heading out to California. Each of you will bike more than 4,000 miles on this trip, so the name the Illini 4,000. You're in Champaign, you're going to be heading back out on the road. What's next? Where are you heading?
We are going north. to Chicago. We go to Bradley first, and then Oak Forest, which is like a southern suburb, and then we have like a day and a half of total rest in Chicago because a lot of us are from the suburbs. And then after that, we head west and we go away from our home. And I've heard from a lot of alumni that it changes after that because you are going away from home. You're going into unfamiliar territory. And the next big thing for you is the end. So, yeah.
San Francisco.
Yep.
That's the end.
Heading west.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, it's called the Portraits Project. You can find a link to it from our website at the21stshow.org. Dakota Carson and Lindsay Coleman joined us in studio here on a stop through through Central Illinois. Thank you very much for being with us, and good luck with the rest of the project.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks for listening here to The 21st. Have a great weekend. I'm Scott Cameron. Nyla Buda will be back on Monday. This is The 21st.